I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. They're back. Well, some of them never left, and some of them, I guess, aren't quite back yet. I'm talking about birds, and boy, are they talking. Have you been listening to the dawn chorus? It is deafening. This right here is a recording from my own yard last month. It's even louder now. So without further ado, let's just get into the show. We are joined for our spring bird show by none other than the bird diva herself, Bridget Butler. Bridget, welcome back.
Huzzah! It's time!
It's my favorite time of the year, mostly because I get to see you.
Oh, likewise, Jane.
All right, so I want us to dive in with some very time-sensitive questions that we've been getting from listeners already. Because,
okay,
you know, I said it's the Spring Bird Show, and often questions come up that are fairly similar. But
yeah,
this year, there's been some weird stuff happening. So let's start with Nichol, who has a question about confused birds.
Okay.
This has been a strange year for birds around our place, Nichol writes. We live in Guilford, and our house is mostly surrounded by woods. Most years, our smallish yard is full of the expected woodsy birds, phoebes, juncos, chickadee, robins, etc. However, this year, we have few or none of those. Instead, we seem to be seeing lots of species that I usually associate with meadows and open places, like goldfinches, orioles, cardinals. Could this be a case of the lack of foliage tricking the birds into thinking they're in a more open area? As leaves start to appear, can we expect the population to revert to, quote, normal?
Normal.
It is a late spring.
Well, yeah, and this is really interesting because if you think back to the fall show, we were kind of talking about some of the same type of weather patterns that were affecting where birds were on the landscape. And so we're kind of getting that same sort of thing happening. We're in a delayed spring. The weather has actually kind of held birds back a little bit. So it shifts and it changes. So you can't expect the same thing every year. I think also we're still in a place where there's a lot of wild bird food available, so that birds are going to be more dispersed across the landscape. In terms of who's here now and who's left, he mentioned juncos and things like that. So I've been noticing this really interesting shift in my yard. The juncos were around probably up until, let's see, the second to last week of April. And then this shift occurred. And the reason why I knew there was a shift is all of a sudden the juncos were gone and the chipping sparrows were in. And I associate chipping sparrows more with more field edge type things. I'm in the city of St. Albans with some nice hedgerows and, you know, a yard and things like that. But the juncos left and the chipping sparrows moved in. And to me, that's just like that trade-off. Like, it's like, all right, I'm going to move up into higher elevations where I'm going to breed. I'm now going to go to my breeding grounds for the juncos, and the chipping sparrows are still moving in and moving through. So they're like, yeah, Bridget's yard is great. We're going to hang out and eat here for a while. And then we're going to move to where we normally breed. I don't think those guys will be breeding in my yard this year.
So to Nichol's question, it could be the weird weather has sort of moved the timing of everything a little bit.
Definitely. And one of the ways that we track this is when we upload our observations to places like eBird. You can actually go in there and pull up these little histograms that will show you what the typical arrival dates are for certain birds. And you can also see what the early arrival dates are for this year for the state of Vermont, too. So that's kind of cool. You can start to track that.
Okay, so we have two questions, again, timely, about the recent storms that we've been having.
Oh, yes.
So let me start with Becky. Becky says, I had a cardinal nesting in my rhododendron last week. She'd been sitting on her eggs for at least 8 days on Friday when the big thunderstorm rolled through. After the storm, her nest was empty and disheveled. I assume the storm interrupted her. Is it normal for birds' nests to be damaged in big storms, or did she choose a poor location?
Now, I saw the picture online of that beautiful little stick nest, little fine twigs in the rhododendron. So, no, I think she picked a perfect spot. That's like typical chickadee nesting spot.
Cardinal.
Sorry, Cardinal nesting
spot. Or chickadee,
spot.
But in this case, cardinal.
In this case, cardinal. So perfect spot for the cardinal to nest. That rhododendron's got great cover. The leaves stay on that plant much longer. And so as the fresh leaves are coming in, we have some of last year's leaves on there. So great cover. So I don't think that's an issue at all. But man, the winds were strong, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our early nesters probably got batted around a little bit. And, you know, some birds can get two broods off in a season, and that's typical for them. Others, when a storm happens like this, if they have the energy reserves and it's early enough, they may be able to lay a second set of eggs.
All right, let's hope.
I know, fingers crossed.
All right, and here's one from Eliza in East Barnard who says, what happens to birds during strong winds like we experienced on Friday night?
Yeah.
For a few days prior, a flock of 8 red-winged blackbirds were picking up seed where I had a bird feeder. They haven't returned since the windstorm. Maybe they've moved on, or maybe this is another peril to our beloved birds. What do you think?
Sure. I think some of these big storms can definitely impact the lives of some of these birds. So we're probably going to lose some here and there. I love this question. I love thinking about and looking at the landscape and thinking about, if I were a bird, so I'm going to put myself in that place of that red-winged blackbird, where would I go? And this is a really hard time of year. There aren't a lot of leaves out. Things like cattails haven't developed yet in our marshes. So it's a little bit harder for birds to find that cover. So the one type of cover that's still around and available are all of our conifers. And so those are the places where I think a lot of birds take refuge in storms like this in order to get out of those winds. And the best place for them to be is probably like really close to the trunk. Mm. Or if you're a cavity nesting bird, you know that cavities are a great place for shelter. And so these are two reasons when we start to look at our backyard or if we have larger properties that we can think about, how can I keep conifers on the landscape and how can I keep snags and deadwood on the landscape? Oh my gosh, Jane, brush piles too. like here's the other thing, like things that fall down after windstorms. A lot of people want to clean all that stuff up, leave it down, leave it messy, because that's also a place where things like sparrows and wrens can take shelter in storms or just hide from predators during the breeding season.
See, I have a big problem with this, Bridget, because we have a couple of brush piles that we need to burn at some point. So it's a lot of, you know, dead trees, mm-hmm. dead sticks, a couple of Christmas trees.
Yeah.
But Jim Andrews told me I could make a snake hotel out of that by putting a tarp over it. So now I don't know whether to make a snake hotel or a home for birds.
Oh my gosh, make a snake hotel because it'll be good for birds as well. You know, we went around and collected all of our neighbors' Christmas trees. And just the other day, right, it was on my daughter's birthday, on Alexis's birthday, we are hanging out. We're all having like birthday dinner and in swoops this Cooper's hawk. And we had lined up all the Christmas trees near the feeders so that the birds could take shelter. Pretty good thing, because the Cooper's hawk came swooping in and landed right on top. And all I could picture was like three little white-throated sparrows like under there going, don't move, don't move, don't move, until that hawk flew away.
We're talking with bird diva Bridget Butler, and Zahan is on the line from Alberg. Hi, Zahan. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah, so I live in Alberg, and there's bobolinks already. And usually they're here a little bit later.
Yeah.
And they're here until farmer cuts the fields, and then they just go. Where do they go?
Where do they go? They're going to find another field. So bobolinks typically are week one. What I'm looking at right now is like a little cheat sheet that I've made that kind of breaks down by week when birds are expected or predicted to arrive. And it is based on the eBird data that you can find online. And so in my list for week one, bobolink is part of that. I have had reports from other people that they had them last week, so a little bit early arrivals. So when the farmers do cut the fields, that does impact this bird. So they're just going to like pop over to the next field that has that grass cover still on it. There's a number of different programs that landowners can get involved in that will help them manage their property for different types of birds. And there's the Bobolink Project, where if you're a farm, you can apply for funding that will help you delay the cutting of your field so that you can allow those bobolinks a little bit more time to nest and get their young off.
Describe what a bobolink looks like, because not everybody has seen. This is not like a chickadee that
these
everybody
guys are
knows.
Like crazy birds. So smaller than a robin, and they are black and white and yellow. And so the yellow is in this like weird like bonnet shape on the back of the bird's head.
Bridget's getting out her trusty field guide.
I'm flipping through my field guide so I make sure I describe this correctly to you. So I love it's, and this one says it's a straw colored nape. It's yellowish.
The it's front, a yellow hood.
It's yellow. It's a yellow hood. Like Handmaid's Tale. Oh, geez. Black face, black body. There's a white vertical wing patch and a white rump as well. And these birds love nesting in fields along with our friend the Eastern Meadowlark as well. So if you have bobolinks, oh my gosh, I do too. And that song. So these guys, their two songs have like an insect kind of quality to them. Actually, I think of the bobolink as sounding like R2-D2. Like R2-D2 for you Star Wars fans. So just go to your local field and listen for R2-D2 out in the middle of it and then watch for the bobolinks popping up and around.
And the meadowlark?
And the meadowlark has like a squeaky, they go spring of the year. That was fairly good, I think.
Bridget, wait, I have to tell you about a bird sighting.
Okay.
Just driving through my neighborhood the other day, I saw what I am 90% convinced of, because it was a quick sighting, but we've seen them there before, two sandhill cranes.
Yes. Awesome.
These are not common birds in Vermont, right. So I feel very, very proud.
No, and they're great. Yeah, and you should, because, you know, I have a pair up near where I live in Fairfield, and they're fairly close to my house, and they've been there for years. And they have babies. And every time I go up to see them for a while, it was like I couldn't see them. They were just never there at the right time. And one time I was driving with my husband, and I was like, this is the spot. I never get to see this bird. And he goes, you mean that bird? And he points out the window, and there they are, like, walking across the field. So these guys look like a great blue heron. Their coloration is different. They're more straw-colored. They've got a red patch on their head. And they look ancient. They just look ancient, and they're huge. They're just so big. But we do have pockets of breeding pairs around the state. So you've got one down in your area.
I'm near Bristol. So okay, this was right by Bristol Pond, which has had them in the past.
So I know Proctor, Vermont, also has had a pair in Fairfield. I'd be curious to hear from other people if you're not in Fairfield, Proctor, or that Bristol area, if you've seen pairs of sandhill cranes as well.
Yeah, and you might notice, because when we were driving, my husband and I, and you sort of drive by and think, oh, there's a great blue heron. Wait, no, it's sort of like dusky, sort of tawny. That's not a heron. And then, you know, if you can get close enough and or use your binoculars, you can see that red patch. Yep. But they're very similar looking in passing to a big heron.
Yep. So looking out of the corner of your eye, if you see that tawny, weird, stalky thing in the field, stop.
Stop the car.
Stop.
Let's go to Mary Ellen in Rangeley, Maine. Hey, Mary Ellen. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
I'm really enjoying listening to your show. I just moved to Rangeley, Maine, and I'm actually driving there right now. I just came up from Vermont into New Hampshire. And I was wondering, do you know when the hummingbirds come through Rangeley? You know, that's in the western part of the state, in the mountain area.
Mary Ellen, thanks for the call. You might not know, but Bridget Butler lived in Maine for a while, didn't you, Bridget?
Yeah, I did.
So, yeah, you probably know that area.
Yeah, I worked up at Hog Island Audubon Camp up in the Damariscotta area. So I'm looking at my cheat sheet again here, and it says ruby-throated hummingbird, first week of May. So I would maybe give that like another week or two to get up further north. One of the ways, there are two fun things that you can do during this time of year to start to like track arrivals of birds. There's this new service out by Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It's called BirdCast, and they've actually come up with a way to kind of predict the migration flight happening based on what the weather is predicted to be. Then they put out these gorgeous maps that show you, and if your zone is in red, that means it's going to be hot for migration, so you want to get out there. And so they'll give you a 3-day window that you can look at. And so you can go to BirdCast online. You can look at what the likelihood of stuff moving is. Then they will actually show you some different migration maps afterwards. And you can actually see that the takeoff as it gets dark at night and the air cools. So they're using
those maps are so cool.
I know the weather radar, right? And so the birds, because they're taking off in such numbers, they actually show up on the weather radar. They tend to be the cooler colors in blues and things like that. So, but Birdcast is doing all the hard work for you, so go right there. So you can use that. And then the other thing I like to do is I like to go to eBird and I like to type in the bird's name under the Explore tab. And I can look at, and I take the time period down to current year. If you take the time period down to current year, it's going to give you the sightings that are happening right now. And you can actually look at where people are starting to sight those birds. And what's wonderful about being up north is you can start to see that ripple effect of them popping up in different people's observations.
But you said first week in May for around here, and true to form, I missed it. I had my back to it, but a friend saw a ruby-throated hummingbird this past nice. Weekend in Hinesburg, Champlain
awesome.
Valley. So there sounds like they're starting
yeah,
to come
Yeah, give
back.
Them a couple more, like maybe another week, and they'll be up in Maine.
All right, so John emailed in to say, everyone is wondering, so everyone
everybody
is
this
wondering.
This is pressure.
Yeah, what
okay.
happened to the chickadees? They are always the most abundant species at my feeders, and this year we very rarely saw any.
Mm.
When they did make an appearance, there were 5 or 6 instead of 20 or 30. I and others observed that juncos were very abundant, seemingly displacing the chickadees. What's going on, Bridget? John asks.
Hey, John, sharp observations. Those are really good. And you're right. Everyone is saying this. So there's a couple things to think about here. Again, weather was a big factor this winter. We had really cold weather. And I feel like that pushed the juncos into our area. And juncos are ground feeders. Chickadees aren't so much ground feeders. So when you have like frozen ground and you have the snow covering it up, it kind of forces them to come to feeders to eat. However, at the same time, we had a really high mast and seed year and fruit year. So mast is things like beech nuts and acorns and things like that. And then seeds would be like birch catkins and pine cones and those things. And then the fruits, mountain ash, winterberry, dogwoods, things like that, sumac as well. So across the landscape as we moved into winter, there was tons of wild food available. And really, when birds come to your feeder, they're only spending about like a quarter of their diet feeding on what you've got at your feeder, unless, of course, you're a junco this past year. So some of the things that we need to pay attention to, one, take great notes, right? Like keep those notes, John, from this year. When you take good notes, note the weather. What was the weather like? Was it particularly rainy? This windstorm that we just had, that would be something good to put in your notebook. What was the snow depth like? So then when you go back and you start to compare your data over years, you can start to see some of those trends. It's really interesting when we how much we forget that we know from year to year. And so when we make specific notes like this, we can go back and look and check and see what the differences are.
We are celebrating spring with bird diva Bridget Butler today and hearing some fascinating questions from you. And let's go to Juniper, who's calling in from Essex. Hi, Juniper. You're on the air.
So once my mom and my sister and me were going from the road, on the road from the Bird Museum in Huntington, and I saw this great big bald eagle on the side of the road.
Whoa! It was actually on the road, Juniper? Like, standing on the road?
No, it was right, like, in a little cluster of trees next to the road.
Wow.
Like, in plain sight.
Awesome. Now, I bet you keyed in on the white head, right? Like, did the white head stand out to you, and you were just like, oh, that's a bald eagle?
Yep.
Yes. And that's a really good search image to have when you look for a bald eagle, because when they perch up in the trees, right, they're brown, so they could probably just totally blend in. But if you look for that white head and that big body, you know what you're seeing, don't you?
Juniper, that is an awesome
yeah.
sighting. Thank
yes.
you for calling in and telling us about it. And Bridget, you know, I can remember a decade ago, we were just trying to get a breeding pair,
I know, right?
And now we have more than 20, I think, in the most recent count, 21 or so breeding pairs in 2017.
I don't know if it's 21, maybe 21 babies fledged or something like that. Eugene,
I just looked at
no.
the chart this morning. I think it's well, Tom Rogers from Fish and Wildlife can
yeah.
call in and tell us, but I think it's about 21 breeding pairs and like 35 fledglings.
Okay, so that's amazing, because really, you know, we went from like nothing to then like a little bit, like maybe three or four breeding pairs. And, you know, we were really worried because we had invested a lot of money in trying to bring some back. We had hacked some at Dead Creek area. And hacking is like bringing in young bald eagles.
I was going to say, did you mean
hatching?
Yeah,
no, I don't mean no. So it's a term that's used for when you're trying to reintroduce a bird species. So you have these hack boxes that you put them in. And it's just a spot for them to kind of imprint on and then with the hopes of them coming back. And that would be a really interesting question for Tom at Fish and Wildlife is, have we discovered any of those pairs back in the state? Because I think it's all been like just original pairs. And it's really, really nice to see. You know, I think the important thing for us now is to remember that these birds need their space when they're nesting. They also need dead trees and snags and large trees near waterways. So the more that we can protect buffers along rivers and wetlands and things like that, leave those things intact, we're going to provide and keep habitat on the landscape that they can breed in.
Yeah. All right. So Lewis Porter, John Buck, Tom Rogers, if any of you are listening, give us a call. Let us know about that. But yeah,
it's
Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife says 21 pairs of adult bald eagles produced 35 young. That's according to a news report.
We need to have a party
in October. I know.
That's
pretty cool.
That's pretty significant.
All right. I have a question that I cannot wait for you to answer, Bridget. This came in this morning and we were all like, oh my gosh, this is fascinating. Rick in Westford wrote in to say, our pet cockatiel often responds to wild bird calls. Mostly he just calls back, but sometimes he's clearly excited and other times visibly frightened.
Yes.
Is it possible he knows the meaning of the wild bird calls? Is there any evidence for interspecies communication? And I'll just say, when I read this email at first, I thought he was talking about a cocker spaniel, which I thought was even weirder, but no, cockatiel. So pet bird, but could the pet bird understand the wild birds?
Yes. Yeah, so this is wonderful. You know, I just came back from 4 days in New Hampshire with a bunch of people from the White Pine School, and they offer something called the New England Bird Language Intensive. And I was there as one of the facilitators. And the whole idea is that deep within us, within our ancestry, we are connected to birds. And the way that we're connected to birds is like kind of like co-inhabitants of the same landscape. And we know how to take cues from birds about the larger story about what's going on in the landscape. And I mean this in terms of when birds alarm, they're telling you something. Or when birds have song, they're telling you something. But specifically the alarms, if we pay attention to those, we can start to then be cued in for things to look for, like raptors, like corvids that are coming through and stealing things from nests, like weasels moving down across the ground that are trying to come and sneak up on prey. So these alarm calls, actually different birds can give them off. And if you think of blue jay as an example, that jay, 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 right?
Yeah, it's such a lovely call.
I know. It's loud. It's sharp.
It's obnoxious.
It's obnoxious, which is what alarms are meant to be. So it keys everybody else in and tells them to pay attention. Chickadees do this. So if you're saying chickadee, dee, dee, you're calm and you're cool. You're at your baseline. Everything's all right. If you're singing, hey, sweetie, hey, sweetie, that's their lovely song. That's baseline too. Those are like normal behaviors. But if that bird drops the chick and goes right into D's, dee, 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 and you hear another one go, and then you hear the titmouse start scolding, that's an alarm. And you really want to pay attention to those and look around. I look up and I look for raptors, and I look down and I look for some kind of ground predator that might be coming in, or a red squirrel that might be about to steal something out of the nest. So I'm really not surprised that your cockatiel is keyed in on this. So something that you could play around with is by that open window, sit down and see if you can listen for those same distinctions in sounds. So if your cockatiel is chattering back, making little chattering noises, and you have birds out the window that are just making little those are little contact calls, and they're just trying to stay in touch with each other as they feed and they move across the landscape. And your cockatiel may be like, wait for me, like making those little chattery things back. And songs, if you think about how you feel when you hear some of those bird songs that you love so much. Jane, I heard a hermit thrush for the first time this weekend. And so that beautiful, fluty, ethereal song, right? That's what hermit thrushes are
using.
Can
you do it?
I can't. And you know why, because we talked about this for But Why. That syrinx that birds have, they can harmonize with themselves. And I just don't know how to do that. But your cockatiel may be keying off of those mating songs, those beautiful melodic songs that birds sing in order to display that they are ready to mate and that they have a good territory in which to do so.
But probably not the specific words. Like, cockatiel is not like, hey guys, welcome back. It's been so lonely without you all winter.
Who knows? Maybe they're going to figure this out. Maybe your sit spot is like right there with your cockatiel, and you're going to listen out the window and watch your cockatiel's body language to interpret what's going on.
You better explain what a sit spot is.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this was another practice that's part of bird language, and something that I've been thinking a lot about and trying to incorporate into my own birding repertoire, and it's slowing down. So instead of taking a bird walk, we're going to do a bird sit. And
I think any of us could get behind that.
Yeah, totally, right? And you can sit with a cup of coffee. You can sit with a glass of wine at dusk. You can do it any time of day you want. The idea is that if you return to the same spot over and over again and you sit quietly, when you come into a spot, you're going to push all those birds out and away. And they're going to alarm and they're going to like check you out. But after a while in coming to that spot and then relaxing and sitting quietly, those birds are going to come back in and they're going to go back to their baseline and start doing what they do. And that's when things get really interesting. And you can start to see some of these day-to-day behaviors that birds are exhibiting. And you can see some of the alarm calls come up, and then you can start to try to solve some of those things as well. So a sit spot, mine is like literally right out my back door. A couple steps down, I have a really great view of my backyard. I go for 20 minutes in the morning if I can. And it's been a way for me to get to know my usual suspects in my backyard, kind of figure out who's nesting and where, who the predators are in my neighborhood. I know Cooper's Hawk is there, and how they're all interplaying with one another.
Let's go to Nancy, who's calling in from Glens Falls, New York. Hey, Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go right ahead.
I'm enjoying the show very much. I saw two huge, very healthy, pileated woodpeckers. I work at Saratoga Lake, and they were right outside pecking a tree right outside my office window.
Ah, awesome. That's a cool sighting.
Yeah, they were huge and, you know, gorgeous. But I just wondered, because they're both males, right? So is that unusual to have two males together? I've only seen a single male.
Do you say these are two males because they both have the red crest, Nancy?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Am I wrong?
I think pileated's both, they both look the same, don't they, Bridget?
Ding, 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 ding. Jane, way to go. I don't even have to be here now. Jane's
yeah,
just
right.
going to
okay,
take over.
Yeah, nobody would like that show, Bridget. But yeah, so, pileated, that could be a male and a female, Nancy.
Yeah, so what you want to look for with the male, the red comes all the way down the forehead to the beak. And then the male also has a little kind of cheek patch of red that extends back from the beak. The female's is like a almost like a perfect triangle on the top of the head. And so that's really awesome. That makes it really easy in a way to tell male from female, but it's different than the other ones.
Yeah, and it's cool, Nancy, that you've got such a great spot to see them because you can get close enough, it sounds like, to actually see them.
Gosh.
So we have a bird ID that we need help with, Bridget. Patrick says, I put a bird feeder in our window for our 2-year-old daughter, Scarlett. We put black oil seed in the feeder. Now we have an insane amount of birds coming to our bird feeder. I've attached a photo. My dog, Tank, is a big fan of the feeder, too. Ha. What type of bird is in this photo? Its head is red, and it looks like a small finch. And here's a color photo that I'm going to hand you, Bridget, of this bird.
So this photo is adorable because the dog is like sitting on the edge of the couch with his hands up on the, or with his paws up on the arm of the couch, looking at the window feeder. And I'm this is great. Your 2 year old is gonna love this. And I'm really impressed that you're like, yeah, it's a finch. So you already know what family it belongs in. And then you got to like take out the possibilities. And we have a couple of finches that kind of have that pinky color, pinky like raspberry or cranberry color to their head. And that's where it gets a little bit harder. So in your bird book, I would look up purple finch and house finch. And they both, they're both finches. They both have the cranberry color on them. Purple finch is going to be just a little bit larger, and the cranberry wash kind of goes throughout their back, right down their back. So it's like that cranberry in brown. House finch, less so, and their streaks on the side of their body are much more brown. So the pink stops as it goes down the breast, and then there's these brown streaks with white. It takes a little bit of time to be able to distinguish between the two, but I think with a nice cup of coffee and a sippy cup for your two-year-old, you're going to be able to clinch this ID.
All right, we've got some sightings to share with you. Patty says, I saw a bird this week, small like a goldfinch, pointy beak, sparrow-colored back, breast a deeper yellow than a goldfinch, like a daffodil. Sounds like a goldfinch, but maybe not.
Sounds like a goldfinch. And you know what's tough about goldfinches right now, Jane?
They're changing.
Yeah, they're changing. Their full molt hasn't come in. And these guys breed a little bit later in the summer. So that full molt, that nice vibrant yellow that we normally think of, hasn't fully come in yet. See if you can snap a picture and get it to us, and we'll help you fine-tune that identification.
Lynette says, every year I know when to put up my hummingbird feeders, which is timed exactly with when my wild gooseberry bush blooms. The hummers love it, and it is a sure thing. Also, after several years of research and finally hatching one of the caterpillars, I found that the hoary question mark butterflies were the culprits feeding on the gooseberry leaves at the same time. This is also an annual event, but all is forgiven. And then Peter says, this is my favorite Vermont edition, the Spring Bird Show with Bridget. But I just want to report that the bobolinks are back in Hyde Park, too. But they no longer nest along the fields at 10 bends due to haying. But when I first moved to these parts almost 30 years ago, the fields along the river were just resplendent with them. I always liken their appearance to skunks. Also, the wood thrush is back. But I want to report an unusual sighting, a juvenile male mockingbird in Elsa French Park in Hyde Park Village with his handsome bright wing bands and long bobbing tail. He was singing this morning in the wee dark hours.
Okay, he needs to write a book because that was beautiful. I love the word resplendent. So yay, mockingbirds. You know, like one of my embarrassing moments as a birder is when, you know, my husband makes bird IDs for me. it's rubbing off on him. He's not much of a birder. But in St. Albans City a number of years ago, in the other house that we lived in, he was like, Bridget, there's a bird in the backyard, and I don't think it's like a normal one, one of those normal ones. He's like, it's definitely different. And I came out, and it was a mockingbird. And I was like, way to go. Way to go. You knew that was not something that we normally see. And so we don't tend to get to see mockingbirds too much. But they pop up here and there now and then. And in the case of the bobolink, you know, I think one of these things with mowing is in part building relationships within our community. And so, you know, hosting a talk on bobolinks and grassland birds can be really good. You know, Audubon can do that. I can do that. There's folks from UVM who are working on bobolink studies. And sometimes when we start to build a relationship with farmers or landowners in our community, over time, we can start to like talk to them about what are our options. Maybe that person's never seen a bobolink before, and they are pretty amazing between the sound and the way they look. So just something to think about.
So earlier in the show, we were talking about bald eagles. Juniper, who's six, had a great bald eagle sighting, and we were talking about the number of pairs. And Tom Rogers from Fish and Wildlife wrote in and said, hi there, I just heard my name was mentioned on the bird show and they had a question. Happy to call in. Let me know what you're looking for. Tom, we were trying to verify 21 breeding pairs of bald eagles. Bridget thought I was wrong about that. She didn't think it could possibly be that high.
Blown away. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's the question, but I've already answered it.
Jane's like, I got this. I got this. That's why we're such a good team.
That's right. So moving on, let's go to Margaret, who's calling in from Newport. Hi, Margaret. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yes, I was going out. I would like to share, we do have a nesting pair of eagles on Lake Memphremagog right here around the corner in Newport.
Oh, cool.
But today I went to lunch to get my salad, and I was looking up, and in the park I noticed these big birds, and I had just turned your program on. And so I went over to the park, and high up one of the lights that shine down on the soccer field, there are, I think, osprey, which I'm quite sure, building a nest on the top of the lamp.
Oh,
yes.
Margaret, that's a neat sighting.
They're kind of sad. I don't know how long they'll stay there, but yes.
Oh, neat sighting, Margaret. Thanks for that. And, you know, ospreys do build on the tops of, you know, light poles, and sometimes there are platforms that have been put up for them.
Yeah, and so you can encourage them to nest elsewhere, someplace safer, by putting a platform nearby, some water, wetland, some feature like that. And hopefully they're in a safe enough spot. And it would be great to be able to watch them as they move through their breeding cycle.
Good spot to see ospreys are on 89 heading up from Burlington. You can sometimes see them from the highway on the platforms and then over on the islands along the causeway.
On the
and
islands.
Stuff.
And then up my way, there's one at Fairfield Swamp that's pretty easy to see as well.
Oh, very cool. So we got two questions about robins who are behaving badly. Not badly, just, you know, perhaps in ways that are not healthy for them, Bridget.
Oh, okay.
So Renee says, we had a robin last week who flew into our upstairs window for hours on end, seemingly all day, every day, for about a week, like 8 to 10 days. And Renee says, I tried putting stuffed animals in the window. I even put paper over the entire window. Nothing stopped it. It's a west-facing window. He started around 5:45 in the morning every day, and he disappeared this week. Any thoughts on why he did this? And before you answer, Kathy says, we have had a robin tapping at one of our windows for about 2 weeks. We tried to hang aluminum pie plates to scare him away. We tucked up an opaque plastic bag as high as we could safely reach. He hasn't given up on the love of his life, whom he sees trapped behind that window, i.e. himself.
Yes.
How can we help him to stop using up his energy on this venture?
No. Right. So here's the crazy thing is that, and I learned this at Bird Language this week, is like during this time of year, like a male bird's brain is just full and coursing with testosterone. And that's like what is just driving them. And so that's where their focus is. So you're right. What's happening is this bird is seeing its reflection in the window. Cardinals are known for this as well. And so the challenge is to break up the reflection on the outside of the window. That's the really key piece. So when you hang stuff inside the window, it's still reflective on the outside. So hopefully you have that type of window that you can, you know, unclip and they tip inward. You can take a bar of soap and you can rub on the outside of the window. I've done flagging tape and like looped it over the edge of the window and then closed the window so it hangs down in front of the window and blows around so it breaks up that reflection.
I just write, don't do it, in lipstick on the
just
window.
Please stop. But you got to break up the reflection on the outside of the window. If it is a window that is like year after year after year they're going for, you might consider another type of screen on the outside. I've seen people put up netting that the birds can just bounce off of when they do see their reflection.
All right. And at least one of them has disappeared. But Kathy, sorry about your amorous neighbor using your window as
the springboard.
So we have a note from Julie who says, I'm going to need a night vision camera for the woodcock who's hanging out in our front yard. I can hear him, spot him on the ground, hear his in-flight song, but just can't see the display. And I'm right with you, Julie. I want a night vision camera for that, too.
Yeah.
Maybe VPR could put that in our budget for next year.
There you go.
And then Kenny says, is there really enough carrion available to support the large numbers of turkey vultures that I see roosting in and around Montpelier? I have counted 25 plus on occasion roosting on Upper East State Street.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so jealous that you figured out where your turkey vulture clan roosting site is. We have a set in St. Albans, and I see them. They're not as many, 8 to 10, and I'm dying to figure out where they're roosting. And you know what? Unfortunately, the answer is probably yes. You know, as we fragment the landscape and we break up habitats, birds are animals, any kind of animal is trying to travel from one forest block or one habitat block to another, and they're divided by roadways. So a lot of what turkey vultures are relying on is roadkill. There probably is just
there's plenty.
Otherwise, there wouldn't be 20 turkey vultures in your vicinity.
Let's go to Jill in Richmond. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm in Richmond, and my boyfriend said he saw a yellow cardinal. And are there yellow cardinals?
Yes, there Ooh. Are yellow cardinals. There was a picture of one bouncing around the internet recently. If you can get a picture of this, that would be really fascinating for the scientists in the region to check out and study. So part of this is related to the bird's diet. So cardinals' diets are enhanced by certain types of berries and foods and gives them their vibrant color. So that yellow one, it's probably a combination of something that didn't work out in terms of the color forming in the birds. So like, what am I trying to say? Like albinism or mm-hmm. leucism in birds, when you see birds that have white patches on them, it's something similar to that. And then it may also be related to diet as well.
I feel like that probably was not the answer that Jill was hoping for. This, you know, now
she wants
you're
it to
siding.
Be something else.
Yeah, no, you're siding with the boyfriend.
Oh,
this
no,
this could
I'm
have been
sorry.
A relationship dispute.
I don't know.
Bridget, let me see. What was I looking for here? Mark emailed in to say, I have a couple questions that have been bothering me, so I thought I'd let Bridget choose the ones she wants. I've been waiting all winter for her. We chose a couple, and
okay.
you can choose which of the couple that we chose that you would like to answer. Mark says, do jays, mourning doves, and others have a pouch or crop to store seeds in so they
okay.
can go tree to tree without breaking them open first? Second, when robins and rock doves first come back and the ground is still frozen, what do they eat?
Mm-hmm.
And how do chickadees make so much noise? They're no bigger than my thumb with a beak the size of a pencil tip.
Yeah, soup. I love
Which
all
one
these.
Do you want?
These are really good. And guess what? You can ask me questions anytime. You just have to email me at birddiva@gmail.com. So don't hold on to all of that bird stress. let it go. I will help you out. Okay, so the first one was the crop question. I love this. This is really cool. So some birds do have this specialized pouch in their esophagus so they can just jam it full of stuff. And if you think of birds like birds of prey, hawks, eagles, vultures, those guys like, you know, would need to be able to gorge themselves on meat, maybe stash it and then come back to it. They can also carry it for a little while in that crop. Gulls and turkeys have crops. You know, gulls eat a lot of junk. So, you know, packing up on that junk. Turkeys like to eat mast. So if you think about, I'm going to eat a whole bunch of acorns and beech nuts and then move on, especially if a predator comes by. And then blue jays, and this is a fascinating behavior to watch. And I would pay attention and see if you can correlate this with weather. So blue jays will really fill up that crop if they're feeling like that they need to stash food. So blue jays are known to be big gobblers at feeders, and then they take off and they go and they stash that in different places. Mourning doves, I don't think so, but those other groups of birds are known to have a crop.
Bridget, before we let you go today, I want you to return to what you're talking about, slow birding, figuring out your
yep.
own neighborhood birds, and leave us with some parting wisdom on how we can all start to do this.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, I've been reading a lot of different books. One of my favorite books right now is this book called Zen Birding, which is by David Whittle and Susan Guyette.
Zen Birding.
And he says, as soon as we surrender that moment, stepping away from the bird and taking it off our list, we have let that beautiful creature slip back into the realm of abstractions, and we've kind of shut off knowing the bird.
So ticking a bird off your life
yeah,
list
you're
is
like,
not really.
Ooh, robin, or just dismissing a bird because you're like, it's just a robin, or meh, it's just a song sparrow, or it's just a chickadee, right? We see those birds all the time, but do we really see them? So what I've been trying to do in my birding practice is just slowing down and trying to watch for more things other than just the identification. What are they doing? What are the behaviors that I can see? Why is that robin like frozen in the middle of my lawn? Why does the chickadee wipe its bill after it eats? Why is there wing fluttering between these two song sparrows? So there's a whole other world that you can see if you just slow down and look.
Well, and if you need some help slowing down, might I recommend you go to birddiva.com. That's Bridget Butler's website. And you can find out all of the events where you might be able to see her. She's doing a ton of them this spring. You can also hire her for various things like helping you slow down and watch the birds. It's at birddiva.com. Bridget, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jane. And thanks for all of you for listening. Great questions.